So yeah, what I'm going to talk about today is actually way too much. So there's going to be some points during the talk where I'm going to like leave it up to you to choose which parts of this I sort of spend a bit more time on talk telling you about, and which a bit less. But this is work that it builds on these two key papers that are up here. So one on Hamiltonian simulation with Ashley Montanaro and Stephen Piddock at the University of Bristol. And the second one on use that uses some of that machinery and theory that we built up in that paper and following papers, a paper together with my PhD student Tamara Kola, which is this says to appear. I have failed to delete that from the slide. The reference is right at the end, but then the archive reference is right, but it's actually now appeared in Journal of High Energy Physics. And there are a number of papers. These papers, as you can see, are from a couple of years back. There are a bunch of follow-up papers that build on these. That, and if you look for combinations and permutations of these authors, you'll find also the kind of papers that have built on this subsequently. Great, and as you said, I mean, this work is work that I've done in with my UCL hat on. I'm also funded by the Royal Society. I have a spin-out company, Phasecraft, which does fund me. This work is actually predates that I'm going to talk about. Mostly predates the existence of Phasecraft, but some I put it up there because especially the first half of this is kind of the seeds of some of the kind of seeds of how why we founded Phasecraft, at least the inspiration for some of the things we're doing now in Phasecraft, which is much more applied to do with near-term applications of quantum computing. So I'm not going to talk much about that, but it's kind of here are the seeds of that house of the spin-out company in some sense, the intellectual seeds. Good. So the talk, this is really a talk in two halves. So Hamiltonian simulation for half, or rough, or plus or minus something, and then I will talk about how that relates to holographic duality in the second half, plus or minus epsilon or delta. So let me start off with the first half of the talk is all about Hamiltonian simulation. So let me start by, I mean, I'm now officially a computer scientist and have been for a few years now, even though I'm really a mathematical physicist. Masquerading as a computer scientist. But I think we learned some pretty important lessons from computer science. And I often start by talking about this these days, that one high-level message we learned is that the physical medium that information is stored on isn't really important. What Shannon's kind of insight in some sense was that you can develop a mathematical theory of information that is independent of whether your information is stored on hard disks, USB sticks, and similarly, computation itself. Turing realized developed a theory of computation that kind of predates that sort of hardware that actually ran it. But the hardware that you run on, you know, you might think you're running on a x86 desktop, but in fact, typically these days, that's being simulated somewhere in the cloud, and that machine doesn't really exist. It's a virtual machine, and that virtual machine sits somewhere on Earth. Who knows where? Probably not in California, as this indicates, because that's probably too expensive nowadays. It's probably sitting in somewhere where electricity is cheaper. And all of this is being simulated on ET's smartphone. And is in fact, the whole thing's running on ET's smartphone. And you just don't care. Because from the perspective of anything you do, it makes no difference. And you can't even tell whether it's this x86 desktop or whether this is some virtual machine being simulated by something else, which is simulated by something else, by something else. And this kind of notion of, I mean, it has the fancy name in computer science these days of virtualization, but it's really the fact that you can simulate one computation with another computation, and what the computation, the nature of the computation doesn't depend on what the physical medium is. And physicists have been virtualizing physics for even longer than computer scientists have been using the word. This is not the right forum for a live audience, but usually, I mean, when I give this talks related to this topic, I usually ask if anyone recognizes this. And at least usually, I think every time at least one person has recognized that this is in fact a something, it's actually a model of the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona made by Gaudi. This top left is a model made out of string and sand that is simulating the physics of a very different type of physics, which is stone in compression rather than string under tension. And Gaudi built these models to, in a very relatively simple way, but nonetheless, simulate with one piece of physics a completely different piece of physics to figure out how to construct the building so that it stayed up with these unusual curves. More recently, in quantum computing, quantum information, we've been virtualizing physics for actually in the lab for nearly 20 years now. This is like a cartoon picture of an optical lattice, and one of the key applications of quantum technology is likely to be simulating physical systems. And one way you can do this is to just engineer your optical lattice to have the Hamiltonian of a different system, like a high temperature superconductor. And then, although the physics of an optical lattice is completely different to that of a high temperature superconductor, you can make the physics of the optical lattice, or the at least the abstracted physics, replicate the kind of behavior of some completely different physical system. And this has been done really successfully for nearly 20 years now in the lab. So this goes by the name in our field of Hamiltonian simulation. And let me just contrast this with a different type of simulation. So in this talk, what I'm talking about is physical simulation. So, or people also call it analog simulation, where you actually build a Hamiltonian that has the same form as the Hamiltonian you want to study. Whereas the famous Hamiltonian simulation algorithm that, you know, dating back to 1995 and Lloyd, or even arguably back to Feynman in 82, 83, there's been a huge amount of refinements of that algorithm since, especially since 2000 and 2010 even. That's a digital simulation algorithm, so that requires a quantum computer to run. It's a very different type of simulation in some sense. And I guess not a perfect analogy, but a decent one, is that this physical simulation is like building a model of an aerofoil and sticking it in a wind tunnel and studying the fluid flow over it. Whereas a digital simulation is analogous to doing a numerical fluid dynamics computation on a supercomputing cluster. So this talk is entirely about the notion of the physical simulation or analog simulation. I'm not going to talk in this work about digital quantum simulation algorithms. Okay, so this has been done, I said, in the lab for about 20 years, but there really wasn't very much theory behind what it actually means to simulate one system with another. People did it. They built a Hamiltonian, was the one they wanted to study, and then poked the system, and it's clearly working. But we sort of started trying to understand what abstractly does it mean for one system to simulate another. So I can abstract away the underlying physics, and just like let's just talk about, I have some Hamiltonian H, and I somehow want to simulate that Hamiltonian in H prime. What does that mean? How should I define that? So let's just write E for encoding, give it a letter. And what we're trying to look at then is, what are the maps from H to H prime via E of H, how should we define the properties of E such that we're happy to call it a valid simulation? And we took some inspiration from information theory, at least philosophical inspiration here, and took an operational approach to trying to figure out, you know, what should we call simulations? How should we define these mathematically? So we took an operational approach and said, okay, well, what are all the properties if we want to be absolutely sure we have something that everyone will agree is a valid simulation? Let's write down all the properties that in an ideal world you would like this map to have. And then let's see what we get. So first thing you might think of, you would like all the energy levels of your H prime system, so the spectrum, the energy spectrum, to be the same as the original Hamiltonian. And so remember, I'm trying to define, like, put all of the requirements I could have in an ideal world, and I'm going to weaken these later. But this is like, no one will argue that if I can do this, it's a simulation, because these are probably overkill. So all energy levels exactly replicated, because energy levels are something you can in principle measure. So they're physical properties. You want them to be the same in the simulation. All measurement outcomes more generally, which energy, measuring the energy is just one of them. Time evolution, we would like that to be replicated. So if we time evolve according to the simulated Hamiltonian and measure some observable, we'd like to get the same outcome as if we time evolve the original system under the original Hamiltonian and measured the original observable. If we want to capture thermodynamic properties, we want the partition functions to be the same, at least up to some rescaling or perhaps a constant shift, which are not physically relevant. And here's a more subtle one. Local interactions in the system, we would like to be simulated by local interactions in the simulator. Why? There are various ways to justify this or to motivate this, but one kind of intuitive one is that if we have to completely solve the entire Hamilton, many-body Hamiltonian, and typically we're applying this simulating many-body Hamiltonians. If we need to completely solve the many-body Hamiltonian before we can actually figure out how to simulate it, there's kind of no point simulating it in the first place. What we really want to be able to simulate the individual interactions of a Hamiltonian and build up our simulation out of all of the simulations of the local interactions. There's another argument for justifying that this mapping, which is rather different, which is that we want to keep the probabilistic interpretation of quantum mechanics should map between the two. Both of these are sort of ways of justifying why you want this structure. And you might want to, that errors in noise are replicated, slightly more subtle point that actually turns out is probably very important, and perhaps one of the more important outcomes of this piece of work, that you would kind of like errors and noise in your simulation to model errors and noise in the physical system you're trying to simulate. Otherwise, the errors in your system might give you completely results that don't match up with the physics you're trying to simulate. And I could keep on going. I could keep on listing more and more properties here that I would like to replicate. But it turns out, well, there's one I've forgotten here, actually, which is why there's a gap, which is that it's a very trivial one, but we want the simulation to actually be a Hamiltonian. So H primed, if we map physical Hamiltonian H to a simulator Hamiltonian H primed, it had better be a Hamiltonian. So it had better stay Hermitian. This is like property zero that we definitely require, that's so obvious that you almost forget to list it. Okay, and we could keep going, but it turns out we've already gone too far. So it turns out that, well, all of these properties, you can prove that this implies that this map E has a very, very restricted form, which I've written at the bottom here and I'll unpack in a moment. But we actually just need these first three properties, and that already implies that the map has to have this form. And then from that, you actually can derive all of the other preservation of all of the other properties. So just to repeat that again, we have this huge list of complete list of desiderata, and that restricts the map to actually be something very, very simple. And it turns out that we didn't actually need to write down all of these properties, already just the first three there. So the fact that our simulation, our map must map Hamiltonians to Hamiltonians, we want it to preserve the spectrum, the energy levels, and that we want local interactions to map to local interactions, already implies that we have this structure to the map. And that then, from that, you can quite easily then derive preservation of all of the other properties. So these first three turn out to be extremely strong. Let me unpack what this form of this map is. So up to a unitary change of basis, your simulator Hamiltonian is just copies of your original Hamiltonian, any number you like of them, P, and then any number Q you like of copies of the complex conjugate of that Hamiltonian. And that's what drops out of this this first theorem in our the paper with Stephen and Ashley. So at this point, I can go on to kind of race through this, or I think I will probably, unless there are any, I don't know how people would object on Zoom anyway or agree, but I would like to at least give you some idea of how we prove this theorem, because I think this audience will be interested in that. And we'll see that maybe I have a little bit less time to talk about quantum gravity fun stuff at the end. So if anyone would prefer me to skip proofs and spend more time on gravity, now's the time to say. And I have no idea how you do that over a Zoom seminar, so you might just have to go with what I decide.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Does U depend on H? Or?
Good question. That's a very good question. So in here, what I'm thinking, and the short answer is no. But because if you remember, this map is not just mapping the Hamiltonian, that's one observable, and it's an important one, but also all measurement outcomes and all other observables. And so for that reason, that actually means that you cannot be dependent on H, because you also want it to map measurements to measurements, observables to observables.
Yeah,
thanks. But that's a good question, thanks. Yeah.
Another question?
Yeah.
Can you go back? Just want to make sure what exactly this can achieve. So when you say partition function, do you mean partition function defined on any manifold, or do you mean just the e to the minus beta h?
I mean e to the minus beta h up to a constant, which is physically not irrelevant. It's kind of obvious to see that you need to allow for a constant rescaling and potentially just a constant shift. But yeah, just e to the minus b to h.
Do we allow to, by partition function, do we also include generating functional? Or I guess that's included in measurement outcomes.
Sorry, to include what? I didn't quite catch.
Generating functional by inserting some source. I guess that's included in measurement outcomes.
Yeah.
But can you, what about the entanglement structure?
I haven't said anything about local, I haven't put a tensor product structure on my Hilbert space yet. So that's a great question, which I will come back to in a moment about, because locality is something I've left off here, or any kind of local structure. So that's a great question, and I will address that and the entanglement structure in a moment.
Maybe let me just make sure this one point I'm really caring about. Does this map, in terms of the quantum many body phases, does it map? Does this preserve the phase?
Yeah, it preserves the whole spectrum. So if the gap closes, and which is a necessary condition for a phase transition, then the gap will close in the simulation. And also all observables, which includes order parameters, are preserved.
Well,
so yeah.
This map, so you mean there's a continuous family of maps?
Yes. That's right. So, well, it's not a continuous family of maps. It's a map on a continuous family of Hamiltonians, which, if you apply the map, will map it to a continuous family of Hamiltonians that are simulated.
But then when you say the gap will close, if this is just a fixed map, and what do you mean the gap will close or not close?
Well, if I start with h of some parameter lambda, and I apply the map E to map it to a simulation, I will get h primed as a function of lambda, and the spectrum as a function of lambda is preserved on both, is equal on both sides. So spectrum of h of lambda for some value of whatever your external magnetic field in the simulation will have the same spectrum as h primed of that lambda.
Uh-huh.
And as you change lambda on the physical side, then in the simulation, change that whatever that parameter lambda maps to, the spectrum will change in the identical way.
Okay, thanks.
Great. Good. Any more questions? Good. Okay. So let me at least delve a little bit into the mathematics of this, because it's kind of nice. I'm not going to give the whole proof, but I want to give you a kind of insight into why it is that the key thing is that these three properties at the top, which are really rather, they don't look very restrictive. It turns out that these are really very, very rigid. So Hermitian preserving, spectrum preserving, and convex or linear over the reals, as I've written it here. In fact, you can just, convexity is enough. These are actually very, very constricting properties on maps of operators in this way. And to prove that goes back to some very nice maths from the 1960s. So here's the full theorem. Here's what I started off with. So we've got the three properties, Hermitian preserving, spectrum preserving, and here I've written convexity, because it turns out convexity is enough. And from that, you can quite easily prove that if convexity holds, then that plus Hermitian preserving implies linearity over the reals. And here's an intermediate statement. So the theorem is that these three characterizations of this map are equivalent. Okay, so in the second one there, the one I've just added, a lot of these look kind of, let me highlight one thing, which is the strong property here is the fact that you have, I don't know if you can see the pointer, but you have E of AB equals E of A times E of B. So the fact that the map has to be preserve the multiplication of operators is something that isn't in property one, the collection here. It doesn't appear here at all. It's not obvious why this should have to hold. The fact that it has to preserve addition of operators, kind of you can figure probably you can lift that from convexity. Hermitian preserving obviously just follows through. Identity preserving is kind of follows from the spectrum preserving. But this one is the really strong one. The fact that the map, these three things, spectrum preserving, Hermitian preserving, convexity preserving, imply that the map has to actually preserve the multiplicative structure of the algebra. So that's the only one you should be surprised by, really. Okay, for this, we have to delve into some old maths that dates kind of back to the foundations of quantum mechanics. It was an alternative attempt by Jordan and I think Weyl was also involved in trying to construct rigorous mathematical foundations for quantum mechanics. And this kind of got obsoleted by the C-star algebra approach eventually and sort of died out of, fell out of favor. But they looked at these things called Jordan algebras, where it's some, think of them as a set of matrix, n by n matrices, but multiplication is replaced by this symmetric product. So in the Jordan algebra, A times B is AB plus BA. Strictly speaking, what I've just defined is a special Jordan algebra, but the difference doesn't really matter here. So for example, the reason they were interested in them is that this is the kind of natural algebra that observables in quantum mechanics obey. Because if you multiply two Hermitian operators together, you get something that isn't Hermitian. But if you take the symmetric product, then that's one way of recovering something that is Hermitian. And this was their motivation for studying, defining and studying Jordan algebras. And then you've got this algebraic structure. Now note, this is a pretty horrible algebraic structure in some ways because it's not associative. So if you do A times B first and then times C, that's not the same thing as doing A B times C first and then pre-multiplying by A. So it's a non-associative algebra, which is kind of not something we typically encounter. But okay, you can define homomorphisms of this algebra. So things that preserve the algebraic structure, the usual thing. And first theorem, which dates back to the 50s and was sort of completed, one case was filled in by Martindale in the 60s, is that any Jordan homomorphism, there is a unique extension of this to a homomorphism on the matrix algebra. So let me go back. Here's the Jordan algebra. I've defined the Jordan product in terms of the matrix product. And I've defined the symmetric Jordan product, A circle B, to be defined as the symmetric product where you use normal matrix product product of operators. This is why this is a special Jordan algebra. I'm defining it to be embedded within a normal matrix algebra with normal matrix multiplication. And so this theorem shows that as long as you've got a n by n matrices with n at least two, then any Jordan homomorphism can be extended to a homomorphism of the matrix algebra. Second theorem is that if you've got a map, the second ingredient I need is that you've got a map from Hermitians to Hermitians that preserves the identity, that preserves the spectrum, and that is linear over the reals, then one can prove that this has to be a Jordan homomorphism. Okay, I'm not going to prove either of these theorems. In fact, the proof of the first one is not trivial. By the way, Martindale filled in the case n equals 2. Jacobson and Rickert proved it for n bigger than or equal to 3, and Martindale got the n equals 2 case. Okay, but these two theorems are the key to proving this characterization, because the first one is the one that gives us the fact the second one tells us that what we are dealing with here is a Jordan homomorphism, this map E. And the second property, the first theorem then tells us that if we've got a Jordan homomorphism, then it doesn't just preserve the Jordan structure, it preserves the matrix algebra. And that gives us this slightly surprising fact that this has to preserve products of matrices. So let me, I've just talked through what exactly this slide. So spectrum preserving implies that we have, from spectrum preserving, you can lift that to the fact, or can use that to show that it preserves the identity, it preserves the zero matrix. Convexity all means that you can, plus spectrum preserving means you preserve, it's linear over the reals. Theorem two then implies it must be a Jordan homomorphism. Theorem one then implies that this extends to a matrix algebra homomorphism, and that gives that key multiplicativity preserving property. The remaining properties are kind of not so difficult. There's some kind of neat tricks to prove it, but they're not so difficult and not so deep. Okay, that gave us kind of this part two of the theorem. So that implied one, that sort of give you a sketch of how we prove one implies two. Now to prove two equals three, so to now go from this characterization, we've now got a matrix algebra preserving map. Now we want to show that this is enough to then give us a full characterization of what this map has to look like, the structure of it. And for this, you can identify within this, define the matrix J to be whatever complex I times the identity maps to. Then J squared has to square to minus the identity. And then this means that J has eigenvalues plus or minus I. Okay, easy bit of maths. of linear algebra. Now it's very easy. It's easy to show that J must, this matrix J we've just defined, the image of complex I times identity, has to commute with everything else in the all other operators that we map from, because it commutes in the original algebra. Identity matrix commutes with everything, so the image of it has to commute with everything in the image. This means we can decompose the entire image space into two orthogonal subspaces. One, the plus I eigenspace of J, and the minus I eigenspace of J. So we can just split the whole thing into two pieces. And now if you look at the maps restricted to each of these subspaces separately, then all of the properties that we had before imply that this map now on each of these subspaces is a C star algebra homomorphism, or a skew C star algebra homomorphism in the minus I eigenspace. And this now, using standard representation theory of finite dimensional C star algebras, is exactly what gives you this form. So C star algebra homomorphisms have to have essentially the form that I just wrote down here. And the other piece of them, the anti-star homomorphisms, these just have an analogous structure. And so basically, that's, again, I've just sketched kind of the ingredients that go into proving this. But from this, you see that those, once we've got that multiplicative preserving property plus the others, that gives us enough to then see that the structure of this map is kind of a combination of a two C star homomorphisms effectively, and then we can use standard C star algebra representation theory to get to that final form. Okay, for those of you who don't like maths, can wake up again. This is where we got to. So maps that preserve every single property we could ever want to preserve in physics have to have this extremely rigid form. We just have copies of the original system and maybe some copies of the complex conjugate of that system. This preserves everything exactly. And that's, of course, ridiculously strong. So if I'm really going to simulate a Hamiltonian, it's never going to be a perfect simulation. There are always going to be approximation errors. Secondly, I haven't said anything about efficiency. I could, you know, this map could use all of the particles in the universe to simulate a single qubit. We want to actually have some way of accounting for what the overhead of the simulation is, or understand or measure its efficiency. That's something we definitely want in a theory of Hamiltonian simulation. And the thing I didn't talk about and flagged that I would, we want to preserve the locality, in the sense that if we've got a many body system, when the simulation, we want to kind of the local interaction structure of the original system, we want to kind of, in some sense that we should pin down, we want it to kind of be reflected in the simulation as well. We don't want to have to construct a massive, you know, n-body interaction to simulate something that's just made up of local interactions. So we care about locality, or if you prefer, the entanglement structure. Finally, there's something else we might want to relax a bit, which is maybe we don't care about simulating our simulator being correct, the whole physics of the simulator being correct. Maybe we only care about simulating the physics within a subspace of that simulation system. So this is true in the real world. If you have an optical lattice, which is you've engineered to simulate the Fermi-Hubbard Hamiltonian, if you turn the lasers up and your optical lattice extremely strong, you dial up the power, eventually your apparatus will explode. And that's not part of the physics of the original system anymore. So the optical lattice only is going to give good physical simulation as long as you stay within a reasonably low energy subspace. And that's kind of, again, something that we typically might want to allow. Okay.
Hi, sorry. I had a quick question about back when you were trying to prove you were imposing the requirement that multiplicativity is sort of also present in the simulated.
So I didn't impose it, I derived it, but yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But is there a reason why we would care about, if you're saying that that's derived, then.
Yeah. So I start, the physical assumptions are part one of this theorem. And there's no multiplicativity is not required at all. Just Hermitian preserving, energy spectrum preserving, and convex. That's it. Just turns out that that's extremely strong.
So this is like much stronger than just proving a simulation of the commutation rules.
That's right.
Thank you for that clarification.
So right, because that's a good point. So because multiplication is preserved, commutation is also preserved, which is, you'd expect in quantum mechanics, commutators play an important role in generating, right, for example, the dynamics. And so, but multiplication preserving is stronger than that. And it's surprising mathematically, or at least was surprising to me, that from such rather apparently weak assumptions or axioms, turns out that this really actually is much stronger than it looks. It's really the combination of that you need all three there. It's you couldn't prove this without all three of these things, but it's just Hermitian Domitian, spectrum preserving, convex, turns out to have, through this Jordan algebra, old Jordan algebra stuff, turns out to be very strong.
Right. So then is that like, so this is sort of a spin-off of the previous question, which is that knowing that you have this stronger version of like what is expected from the simulated multiplication, is there any intuition for like why it's the commutators and not like the individual multiplication terms, which are so prominent in quantum mechanics?
Oh, that's a great question. But I'm going to defer it. There's an entire book dating back to which kind of builds up quantum mechanics from this kind of starting point, and to some extent builds up all, shows that all the way from starting from something very similar, the Jordan algebra structure, it turns out that from that you can kind of show that it forces you to have the C star algebra structure, and then you have the Lie algebra structure, and this is partly why people have forgotten about this stuff. It's because it turns out it's completely equivalent to all of the other ways of putting the foundations of quantum mechanics on a mathematical footing, but it's Jordan algebras are ugly because they're non-associative. That's a great question, and I can point you to a book on this.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know much about like C star representation theory or whatever, so I just wanted to.
Really sounds fancier than it is. It's really what I've used is really like in chapter zero of C star algebra textbook. It's nothing particularly deep. It's normally people don't even prove that particular case because it's finite dimensional, and that's kind of, you know, the algebra of the mathematicians think that's easy. So it's kind of a special case of compact C star algebra, I think.
Cool.
So it's not it's nothing thank very you. Difficult yeah. that I've used here. It's very basic stuff.
Okay.
It sounds fancy. Okay. Yeah. I just went through sort of a sketch through go on.
Question? Yeah. Just want to make sure if the U is local.
I haven't said anything about locality yet at the moment. There's no tensor product structure so far. I'm about to put one in there.
Okay.
So these are the things that I want to kind of, what I've done so far is just a baby version of the theory. It's much too restrictive, and I haven't taken into account things like locality. I haven't said anything about it. I haven't said anything about efficiency. So this is kind of like just the very first, attempt. And now we need to do better to characterize what simulations should look like. And I don't want to go through it because it's quite a lot of maths. I wanted to give you a flavor for the kind of simple version. But first thing you can do is define or derive in the same way, similar kind of way that I just went through for the exact simulations. I can instead relax to only requiring approximate simulation. So H prime simulates H to some precision in some up to some energy cutoff, blah, blah, blah. And you can characterize it. And I've written it up here, but I think I'm not going to talk through exactly what them. It's not important to digest exactly what this means mathematically. And then it's easier to understand this in pictures. So the energy spectrum is now preserved up to small errors epsilon. And there could be some junk that's at very, very high energy that's completely wrong in terms of the spectrum, but it's separated from the low energy part by a gap delta in energy. So that's what this characterization gives you on the eigenvalues. And I put, there is a hidden in here, you can see that this map now that at the bottom, which used to look like U times copies of H conjugate, this has turned into something a little bit more complicated where you have local isometries now instead of a global unitary. So again, I'm just going to draw a cartoon picture of this. This now characterization or of approximate simulation now has a notion of locality where essentially if you've got a qdit in the original system, it maps to some particular subset of qdits in the simulator system. I've drawn them all being three particles here. It doesn't have to be the same number in each. It's rather general. But there should essentially, for every particle in the original system, every qdit in the original system, there is a specific set of qubits in the simulator system. So if you want to measure an observable on one particle in the original system, that's equivalent to measuring an observable on that set of three particles, say, in the simulation. So now we have a notion of locality. And just to go re-emphasize, what physics are we replicating? Well, everything. If you can then prove that if H primed delta epsilon eta simulates, there's a typo there. If H prime delta eta epsilon simulates H, then the energy spectrum is preserved up to error epsilon. The partition function is preserved up to small errors. The time evolution is preserved up to small errors, and all measurement outcomes and observables are preserved up to small errors. And the if you start with a local observable, then the simulated observable is also local. And similarly for interactions in the original Hamiltonian, those are also observables. So local interactions map to local interactions, and so on and so forth. Good. How am I doing for time? Yeah, are there any questions?
So is U local?
Well, U has now turned into V tensor N. So yes, this U now has a local structure. It's now got a tensor product structure. Okay. And again, this is if you want to simulate things approximately within but you allow it to be within a low energy subspace, you're happy to only have it correct within low energy subspace, then your map has to take this form. So that's all you can have. And I haven't talked through what mathematically this means, because I think it's perhaps not better to read that in the paper.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Good. Let me relate this to something that is probably much more familiar to you. And that's this simulation and quantum error correction encodes one system into another. Simulation seems to encode one piece of physics into another. And indeed, an error correcting code is a special case of what I've defined as to be simulation. So it's a delta zero zero simulation. The code space is then the low energy subspace, the subspace with energy below delta. And think about stabilizer codes. If you take the stabilizer and multiply that stabilizer Hamiltonian and multiply by delta, then you can sort of see how this matches up. And it's a perfect simulation, and it doesn't allow any complex conjugation. So you don't have any, and you only have the sort of non-conjugated part. So again, this is probably a typo there, really. I should have just deleted the A direct sum Q part here. So a quantum error, if you take that, you just plug in like delta, take epsilon equals zero, eta equals zero, and take Q equals zero in the form I wrote down, you get that the map is just an isometry, and it just has the property, it looks like the encoding isometry of an error correcting code. So these are special cases. Quantum error correction codes are special cases of simulation with P equals one, Q equals zero, and perfect simulations. So approximate simulation, again, if you take P equals one, Q equals zero in this form, in this def, this characterization, but now you allow errors, then you get something you get an approximate quantum error correcting code. Okay, and I'm going to skim through this. One thing we used this for in that big 80-page Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences paper was to then, build up all this mathematical theory. What's it good for? Well, it turns out it's good for proving very strong results in Hamiltonian complexity theory. So I'm going to skim through this because I would like to talk a bit about gravity. So what we showed is that this allowed us to prove that there are universal quantum Hamiltonians that can, so Hamiltonians, families of Hamiltonians with just some free parameters, that you twiddle the free parameters and you're able to simulate in this very rigorous, precise way I've just defined any other model in physics. And this is nothing to do with universality classes in condensed matter. This is universality in a difference, more in the universal computation sense, like a universal Turing machine. These are universal Hamiltonians. And the surprising thing is that universal Hamiltonians not only exist, but they're actually rather simple. And not only are they simple, we have, at least for qubits, we have a complete characterization of the simulation power of Hamiltonians. And I'm just going to skip, but it lets you. So turns out that even something as simple as the 2D Heisenberg model, where the free parameters are just the interaction strengths, is actually something as simple as that is already universal, which is kind of surprising because that has full local SU2 symmetry. So it's symmetric under unitary local unitary rotations, and yet you can simulate you know, 2D Heisenberg model with this very strong local symmetry can actually, in a very rigorous sense, simulate a five-dimensional theory without any symmetry at all. And you can kind of get half of Hamiltonian complexity theory and a whole bunch of new Hamiltonian complexity theory results just as corollaries now of this general framework. So I've skipped through that because I want to talk instead at this point about, if there are no questions, I want to move on and see how do we go on to make use of all of this in holography? But it's a good point if there are any questions about the Hamiltonian simulation part. That'll be less maths in the second half. Yeah.
Can you remind me what you meant exactly by simulating noise?
I skipped. I didn't. What we could prove is a theorem. That's a great question. So what we could prove is it's obvious that if you have local noise, say, in the physical system, and you look at how it maps, it will map to local noise in the simulator. What we were able to prove is the other direction. So if you have local noise in your simulator, what's the effect of that local noise? Well, it turns out to be equivalent to some local noise model in the simulated physics. So if you've got an optical lattice and the noise in your optical lattice is local, the physics that you're simulating will have errors in it, but the errors will also be local noise in the physics. You end up simulating local noise. And that's something that's about as strong as you can say in a very general abstract framework like this. But we've gone on in a paper that we posted to the archive earlier this year to develop specific simulations for fermionic systems. This is now Phasecraft work. And we showed that within some of these ways of encoding fermions into quantum computers, you had the property there that if you had, they serve as kind of cut down, you know, error detecting codes, and the undetected errors in that fermionic encoding map back to what are you ending up simulating or replicating? It's local phase noise in the fermionic system you've encoded. And so that goes with how this kind of thinking led into, when you start to apply it to concrete examples, you can get something a bit more out than just local is equivalent to local.
But the bottom line is that the general result doesn't tell you about other properties of noise, just locality.
Just locality, but essentially because I haven't put enough into the framework, it's too general, right? There's not, until you start to ask, okay, which noise model and which Hamiltonian are you simulating or which family? It's difficult to say more than that in a completely general way. Once you start to say, okay, I'm going to look at this particular family of error correcting codes, say, or this particular family of simulations, then you can start asking which noise models map to which noise models in a more specific sense. And so we have some follow-up work where we actually made use of that and did that.
Right, okay.
Cool. Okay, good. So I have maybe quarter of an hour to talk about, you know, it seems like going off on a complete tangent, but actually it's very closely related. And let me explain to you how this has anything to do with quantum gravity, or at least holography. So here's the kind of standard, so this is a complete gear change, but we'll see how it connects. And here's a kind of typical toy cartoon picture of holography. You have some quantum gravity in the interior of a cylinder. Really a Poincaré disk picture of hyperbolic space. And somehow that's dual to the physics of a conformal field theory on the boundary. So, okay, I look at that cartoon picture, so-called soup can picture of holography, and, well, this kind of stuff, like I looked at this and it reminds me a little bit of this whole framework of simulation we've developed, because, you know, if you've got the same physics on the bulk and the boundary, then we've just characterized what the map has to look like between those two mathematically. If it's going to replicate the physics, it's got to be a simulation in the precise way I've defined and have characterized. So this must mean that the holographic duality is characterized by a map that has the structure of the map appearing in these, you know, in this characterization of simulations between the bulk physics and the boundary physics. So this is just an idea at this point. But there are some nice concrete examples, toy models of holography. This first one, not quite the first one, but okay, the most important one from our perspective is this so-called happy paper. So Harlow, Preskill, Pastavsky, and Yoshida from 2015, where they actually constructed a tensor network model of holographic dualities. So this is a toy model. It's not gravitational, but it's a toy model exhibiting some of the non-trivial qualitative features of the ADS-EFT duality. And in this tensor network, you have these six-leg tensors. So the red dots here are, think of them as sticking out of the screen. And the red dots are the bulk indices. So they are the qubits that are in live in the bulk. And the white dots, the legs on the tensor, are the qubits that live on the boundary. And the whole tensor network contracted together gives you an isometry from bulk to boundary, which actually has the structure of an error correcting code. And this is error correcting codes, I already said, are a special case of simulations. So this is indeed a simulation. This toy model, this happy code, like all error correcting codes, is a simulation with, you know, P equals one, Q equals zero, and there we go. And this error correcting code is indeed a stabilizer code. So if you construct the stabilizer Hamiltonian, then it's a delta zero zero simulation in the low energy subspace, the subspace of energy below delta. Okay, this is what we've already seen. It's just a specific case of error correcting codes are special cases of simulations. And this holographic error correcting codes are really interesting. They have a very interesting geometric structure, which give a kind of toy model of the duality between bulk and boundary states and observables in quantum gravity, that's, or at least in ADS-EFT duality. But ADS-EFT duality is also supposed to be a duality between models. And if you're talking about toy models, then a toy model of a gravity model is a local Hamiltonian. A toy model, where, you know, toy model of physics is. So we would want, if we're going to construct toy models of gravity, we would like to have a mapping not just between bulk states and observables and boundary states and observables, but also between models in the bulk and models on the boundary. Or even better would be to have maps between models on the boundary and models back to models in the bulk. And what happens if we map a local bulk Hamiltonian to the boundary using something like the happy code? Well, if we take a local interaction that's near the boundary, then the geometric properties of this code, you basically drop you to find out where that, what that maps to, or the support of what it maps to on the boundary, you have to take, drop geodesics in this bulk hyperbolic space to the boundary, and that's the support of your observable on the boundary, roughly. So if you've got a local Hamiltonian local interaction near the boundary, then it maps to something fairly local on the boundary. But if you've got a local interaction deep in the bulk, then when you drop the geodesics to the boundary, you end up with something that isn't local at all. It acts on almost the entire boundary. So if you map a local Hamiltonian through the happy code, you get something with completely non-local interactions, where all of the particles on the boundary, or maybe half the particles on the boundary, all interact, are involved in one interaction. And that's not what you would like. So holographic codes give a good toy model of ADS-EFT for states and observables, but not for models. And if you don't have a good toy model of the mapping for models or Hamiltonians, then you can't really say much about energy scales and dynamics. And that's something you would really like to play with in toy models of gravity. But our universal Hamiltonian results, I said that we had these simple universal Hamiltonians that can simulate everything. So for example, the 2D Heisenberg model. So if I can, and this is a local model, and it's a local I had a notion of locality in my definition of simulation, in my the full definition and characterization. So we actually know that there must be a way to construct a mapping such that local Hamiltonians map to local Hamiltonians. This was just the sort of dream at the beginning, the sort of idea of, and then we explored this with my student Tamara, and it turns out that we were able to make this work. So if we combine tensor networks and this new Hamiltonian simulation framework, you know, the question was, can we get toy models that include duality on the level of local Hamiltonians, a meaningful duality? And it turns out the answer is yes, but there's a problem. The happy code is 2D and has a 1D boundary. And all of the techniques we use to construct universal Hamiltonians only work in two dimensions or higher. And that's the boundary dimension that matters there. So before we can do this, we need to construct a generalization of the happy code where we have at least a 3D bulk and a 2D boundary. Otherwise, we can't get going with these our techniques for constructing these universals. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, I'm just a little bit confused because when we're talking about this ADS-CFT stuff, you're talking about your Hamiltonian mapping.
Yeah.
You were kind of assuming in the Hamiltonian mapping that you had this convexity property. And yeah. It's not clear that at all applies to this ADS-CFT situation, right? I mean...
I think it... well, just like with the happy code, there's no gravity here for a start. This is just holography, no gravity. So I don't want to make any sort of sweeping statements. So getting gravity into these toy models is a challenge that is yet to be really addressed. If you want to, at least in the happy code, it certainly this convexity definitely holds, like in any quantum error correcting code. So if you take a convex combination of observables in the bulk and look at what observables you should measure in the code, in the encoded state, it's the convex combination of the encoded ones. I should say, because it's in a subspace, it's a bit more subtle, and I didn't talk through the maths of that. There exists a convex combination of observables in that you can measure. It's no longer unique, but there exists one.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so... I'm going to skip through the generalization of this, but essentially the happy code tessellates 2D hyperbolic space by rantangled pentagons. And we constructed we used the tessellation of three-dimensional space by right-angled dodecahedra, which is related to beautiful mathematics of Coxeter groups and Coxeter diagrams. And it's much harder to prove things in 3D because at least I can't really visualize hyperbolic space in 3D. But the Coxeter group structure behind these tessellations gives us the mathematical tools we need to actually prove that everything works. And it's beautiful maths, but I'm going to skip it all and say we managed to do it. We construct a three-dimensional generalization of the happy code. And in fact, the framework lets you generalize to any dimensions you can construct Coxeter group tessellations in. We were able to construct this, and now you get something like you have with the happy code. We have a holographic error correcting code that maps from bulk to the boundary here, so a 2D bulk to a 3D bulk to a 2D boundary. And if you push a local Hamiltonian through this mapping, then you get a Hamiltonian on the boundary, just like you do with the happy code, and it's just like in the happy code, it's completely non-local. Okay, great. What do we do next? Next thing we do is we then use our universal Hamiltonian machinery. So the stuff I breezed through but just claimed we could do to construct using these techniques from Hamiltonian complexity theory that we use to prove that there exist and even characterize these universal Hamiltonians, to now construct a second layer of mapping where we map to a manifold that surrounds this finite section of the tessellation. And now this second mapping restores the locality of the bulk Hamiltonian on the boundary. Okay, so the first we map through this holographic error correcting code and we get something non-local, and then we relocalize it using these perturbation gadget techniques and this insights from kind of this constructions of universal Hamiltonians. And simulations compose. So if A simulates B and B simulates C, then we proved that that implies A simulates C. So in this two-stage way, we build up an overall composed simulation that really does map local Hamiltonians of the bulk to local Hamiltonians on the boundary in hyperbolic space. And they are simulations up to errors that can be made as small as you like within a subspace that has energy that is below whatever cutoff you want to do, you want to put. And because of this, all of this machinery because we characterize what simulations are mathematically, we know that because we construct a simulation, then the physics is replicated up to arbitrary small errors. Good. And in the last few minutes, so the important point is that if you've got n qubits in the bulk, what's the overhead here? Well, actually, the boundary model then only has up to log factors, it still has order n qubits. And this, the errors can be made as small as you like as you crank up an energy scale in the boundary Hamiltonian. And where is it? The geometrically, this boundary, this surface, this manifold we construct the boundary model on, is only a distance log log n away from the boundary of the holographic code. So this really is kind of, you can still think of this as kind of a boundary. Good. So in the last few minutes, let me just show you some fun things that you can now say, having constructed, now lifted, built on this, these you know, beautiful tensor network constructions of holographic codes, to now strengthen these to actually give mappings that preserve locality of Hamiltonians. Let's see. I'm going to skip boundary to Mach mapping because it turns out there's a way of because we now, with this Hamiltonian simulation theory, we can actually understand how to go in the other direction and map boundary to bulk. But I'm going to skip that and maybe we can chat about it afterwards. But let me just, since I'm out of time, let me just talk about the fun stuff. Let me talk about black holes. So in the happy code, they had this very, very toy model of black holes and saying, well, a black hole, maybe that's analogous to just deleting a tensor from this network. And there are some arguments about, you know, you recover the entropy, something like the entropy scaling law that you expect from black holes, Bekenstein-Hawking type scaling, but that's kind of by construction because tensor networks always have this area law type scaling. But okay, they sort of posited maybe this is the right toy model of a black hole. The new thing we have from now, but we couldn't say anything about energy scales because we didn't have a meaningful notion of mapping Hamiltonians between bulk and boundary. Now we do, and it does indeed turn out that if you now look at the energy of such a state in with respect to the boundary Hamiltonian, it turns out black hole states in the bulk are equivalent to or map to high energy states that are very highly entangled on the boundary. So that's okay, that's nice. That kind of gives a little bit more justification for calling these toy models of black holes. And the other thing you can do now you have Hamiltonians, and I'll finish, is you can now play games with, well, what about dynamics? Because now we have Hamiltonians, we can generate time dynamics meaningfully. So let's assume that we have a bulk whose dynamics is that of gravity. And let's start in some state where we have a kind of shell of matter that's got low density somewhere near the boundary. And then we just let this evolve. Well, we know what happens in gravity. If we let this evolve, it's going to collapse into the middle. What does this dynamics look like on the boundary? Well, we know how to map this now. And so we start off with some local excitations on the boundary. And then as we time evolve, then these are going to map to much less local excitations on the boundary. So like this, you see that if you've got a initial state that's nothing particularly insightful here. It's exactly, you could have made all of these claims with the happy code. But now let's imagine we start off with a state on the boundary that has relatively high energy above some cutoff that is this parameter delta in the Hamiltonian simulation characterization. Now, you can, because it's got low density, it doesn't violate any of the stabilizers in the error correcting code that's underlying this Hamiltonian simulation, this mapping. So you get large energy not of this state, not because any single particle has high energy, but because you've got a large number of low energy particles. So let's pick an initial state like this that's got intermediate energy. Okay, well, unitary dynamics implies that energy is conserved. So the final state also has energy above this cutoff. But now these excitations, this energy has to come from an operator that's acting only in a very small region geometrically. And that implies, and you can show rigorously, that implies that this must now violate at least one stabilizer in the Hamiltonian derived from the underlying holographic error correcting code. And that in the happy, in I'm drawing happy model, this is actually all in 3D bulk, implies that you have a toy model of a black hole state exactly as posited by in the happy paper. So like this, you can see that at least the picture, a toy model of black hole formation is consistent with that, is consistent with this kind of idea that black holes are analogous. Toy models of black holes are, can be thought of as just deleting a tensor from this network. There's a lot more I could say about that, but I think I'm over time. So I'm just going to conclude by a few open questions. So on the gravity side, we've constructed this holographic duality for any local bulk model. So it doesn't have to be gravity. You can put anything in the bulk and it will tell you how to map it to the boundary. There's no gravity in this. So previously you might have thought that, you know, holography somehow is fundamentally gravitational. Happy code, you know, holographic error correction codes show that it's, you don't have to have gravity to have holography. I mean, that was already known before as well. But then gravity, you might think gravity is key to having kind of, if you're going to have a local model mapped to a local theory, then the local model in the bulk, it's only gravitational models that somehow, because they're inherently holographic, that will map to a local models in the boundary. Our construction shows that nope, that's not the case. I can map anything, any model you like that's local in the bulk to something local on the boundary. So where, you know, at what point, how far can you push these toy models without putting gravity in, I think is a really interesting open question. And turns out that locality alone is not yet enough to restrict you to kind of gravity. You can also do all of these constructions in Euclidean or spherical space. No idea what you do with that. We did it in the paper. We sort of explained how to do that, but I don't know what to, you know, now we've got some toy models of holographic duality in flat space or in positively curved space. I don't know what to do with that, but if anyone has any ideas, please let me know. It could be fun to explore. I'm gonna skip. There's a big question of pushing these toy models further and further towards actual toy models of gravity. What's missing in these our construction is symmetries. We don't have conformal symmetry on the boundary, but we do have some symmetries on the boundary. And the question is, there's an interesting question of whether you can push this further and actually manage to construct mappings that end up with, you generate conformal symmetry on the boundary. And there's a nice approach paper by Stegman and Osborne that kind of, in a very different way, takes steps towards trying to do that. And with that, I'm just going to put up the references. I'm out of time, and thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks a lot, Toby, for the great talk. We've had a few questions during the talk, but does anyone have any further questions?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I actually asked you before, but I don't really understand. I wanted to ask in the first part if this simulation or map really preserves a phase. Maybe let me clarify what I mean by a phase. Here by a phase, I'm not assuming it's gapped, it can be gapless.
Sure.
And let me, just to be general, let me assume I have some symmetries in mind, but you can ignore the symmetries. And then by phase, I mean an equivalence class defined in the following way. It's an equivalence class of Hamiltonians, where the Hamiltonians consists is a sum of many local terms. And when I evaluate the coefficients in front of the local terms in a smooth way, two Hamiltonians has to go through a point where the ground state energy density changes singularly, although I'm varying the parameters in a smooth way. In this case, I call these two Hamiltonians two different phases.
Sure.
From this definition, how do you see you are preserving the phase?
Well, so with that definition of phase, so remember this point down. Can you see the pointer or not? Because if you can, yes, that will help. You can, brilliant. Okay, this one here. So this, the fact that it's convex or you can lift that to linear over the reals means that as you twiddle parameters in the local interactions on the simulation, you're twiddling some corresponding parameters in the simulator.
Yeah.
So real linearity means that there's a, you know, you're mapping the parameters of the one Hamiltonian to the parameters of the other, follows from the real linearity.
Yeah.
Now, as you twiddle those parameters, because of the spectrum preserving, the fact that the map is spectrum preserving, it means that the spectrum changes in exactly the same way on both sides.
So?
So if you go through a phase transition in the physical system, then you go through the same phase transition in the simulated system.
But that doesn't mean H and H prime are in the same phase, does it?
Well, if you take the mathematical definition of phase, a mathematical physics definition of phase, yes. In that two things are in the same phase if they're connected by a continuous path with non-closing gap.
Maybe a concrete example. It sounds like, at least for now, I don't see any contradiction to use your method to map a toy code to a double Samuel, which we know are in two different phases.
How do you know that you can construct a simulation between a toric code and a double semion model?
I don't really know, but I just don't see what the violates.
I mean, this says that the map, if it exists, if there is a simulation that preserves all of this thing, then the map has to take a specific form. If you can't construct a map of that form, then there is no simulation. And so I would say it's the other way around. The fact that you know that those are in different phases implies that you cannot construct a map of this form between them.
But I guess maybe I'm still missing something, but I just don't see, now what we know is just that the spectrums are the same.
Well, it turns out much more, having the same spectrum actually turns out to be so strong that it implies all of the other properties. But if we're taking this, I mean, this is the sort of toy version where you require everything to be exact, but you would have to construct a way of taking the toric code, Hamiltonian age, and putting it together in this way, and that's all you're allowed to do, and get out a semion model Hamiltonian. And I don't think that's possible, because you just have to take copies of the toric code, copies of the complex conjugate of the toric code, but the toric code Hamiltonian, I think, is real. So actually, it's just, you just take copies of the toric, multiple copies of the toric code up to a unit tree. And I don't think that is, there's any way that can give you a double semion model, because that doesn't preserve, you know, they have different properties. They're in different phases, like you said. So I think that just tells you, it's the other way around. This just says you cannot construct a simulation between those two models or a mapping of this mathematical form. So I don't think there's a contradiction. I think it's just consistent.
Okay, thanks. Let me think more.
Sure. So you said this preserves all the measurements you could possibly do, right?
Yeah, and it even maps local observables to local observables when you
so
put
would,
in locality.
Would preserve, for example, the braiding operation, which is different between the code and the semion.
Yeah, which means that you can't possibly construct this map because they don't have the same braiding operation, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. If you take the definition of phase that's order parameter in terms of like order parameters, then it's even clearer to see. If you've got two phases with different order parameters, two Hamiltonians with different order parameters, you can't construct this map between them because those two observables would have to have the same value, and you've just said they don't. I was looking for the local.
So here, when you say local observables, you include something like breeding?
I haven't thought deeply about that, but probably, because not only do you map local observables, you also preserve the entire algebra. So you also preserve products of those local observables and sums of them. And I think that's enough to give you the same braiding algebra. But okay, I'm making this up right now. I haven't thought, that's an interesting question, but I would guess the answer is yes, but I'd have to check.
Previously, when you said local observables, I thought you just meant correlation functions.
No, any local in the sense of k-body.
Yeah.
So if you've got a k-body observable on one side, it maps to a k-primed body observable on the other side, and k and k-primed are, depending on the encoding, there's, you know, that you can have a constant blow up.
Yeah.
There's an important point here that I didn't cover about locality, actually, which is if you encode if you map a 3D system into 2D, which we're able to do, we've constructed things that you can map a 25 dimensional system into two, you can preserve locality in the sense I just defined. So K body goes to K prime body, but you cannot possibly preserve geometric locality, because if you try and, you know, classic theory in topology, if you map the 3D space into 2D space, it cannot be topologically continuous. So when I say local, you can get stronger locality preserving properties, but the general if you're mapping something or simulating something in different spatial dimensions, your some of your local observables are going to have to be things that act on particles that are not next to each other in the 2D plane, and that is easy to show that has to be the case. This is why the holographic applications of this to holography don't follow immediately. You actually have to make the geometry work as well.
Mm-hmm. But just being able to map K body observable to K prime body observable, I guess, is this enough to distinguish toy code and double Samuel? I'm not entirely sure.
I mean, you're the expert on that system, not me. But if there's any observable that distinguishes them, then a mapping with this form can't exist because it preserves all observables. I mean, it preserves locality, but if you have a non-local observable, it also preserves the expectation values of that. Preserving locality is an extra desiderata on top of that.
Okay, I guess actually to distinguish the building one, just need to check the algebra of some string operators. Then if you map one string operator to another, then maybe this is indeed a way to distinguish toy code and double Samuel.
Probably.
Thanks.
But universality result does show, I guess, that the 2D Heisenberg model has double semion phase and every other phase in it somewhere.
That's right. That's right. But probably in a way that you are not going to be so happy with when I actually. Well, basically, it's the 2D Heisenberg model. You can actually make it work on a 2D square lattice. And Ashley and Stephen went on to show that you can do it on some other lattices as well. But the only problem with this is that, it's a Heisenberg model, but where I can change the local interaction strength of every single local interaction individually. So if you're happy with that, yes.
It's not translation invariant, in other words.
It's not translation invariant. It's horrendously non-translation invariant. However, we have a follow-up paper that's on the archive with Tamara and Steve and myself and Johannes Bausch, where we show that you can construct translationally invariant universal Hamiltonians using kind of your kind of techniques, Daniel, from way back when. So actually, there are ways of making this translationally invariant and even doing it in 1D. I should say Stephen and Johannes did that first in 2D or 3D. In terms of simulation. And then we were able to show actually a much simpler proof than that you could do it in 1D.
But
then you've got a horrendously complicated interaction with horribly huge local Hilbert space dimension and a very artificial thing.
It's complicated, but it's still local.
It's complicated, it's local, it's translation invariant. You pull the trick you know very well of you encode some of the information about the thing you're simulating in the length of the chain. It gets complicated, but you can be done translation invariantly as of some more recent archive papers than the ones I've talked about.
And you said it, but it also doesn't depend on the dimension. So for instance, you could there's going to be a fracton phase.
In some sense, yes, but keep in mind that the geometric locality of the observables can't possibly be preserved if you're mapping into different spatial dimensions. Right. So it'll be some weird observable that corresponds to a sensible observable in the fracton phase. But yes, you can do it in some sense. Hi, Debbie.
Can I ask a question if the others are done? Yeah, sorry, I was attending another talk at BNID at the end of your talk. So you mentioned about the simulation to preserve noise, and you focus largely on local noise being simulated as local noise.
Yeah.
Of course, the whole point about air quoting code is to suppress the noise.
Yeah.
So do you see how to achieve the simulation of the physics while simultaneously suppressing the noise? Like, it may be the same structure, but like the noise level will go down and so on and so forth.
I'm not sure I can say more than interpreting this in the context of what we already know about error correcting codes. So let me say two things. So one thing is that we show that noise in the simulator maps to local noise in the simulator maps to local noise in the physical system. If you take an error correcting code and you take local noise that the error correcting code can correct against, it simulates it with it's what it ends up simulating is zero noise. And zero noise is kind of trivially local. So it's a sort of trivial case of the theorem. So there you're kind of doing really well. The local noise that you end up in your, you know, in that you end up simulating is actually the no noise case. What you can do is you can look at things that are not, it starts to get non-trivial where you look at, okay, noise that can't be detected by the code or corrected for, which there's always, you know, noise that is the code can't protect against. So you can start to look at how that noise that is beyond, you know, is more noise than the code can cope with, more errors than the code's distance, can look at what that maps to. And a nice case of that where we've actually done that is in these fermion encodings, where you actually don't have an error correcting code in the simulation, in the encodings we use. You have an error detecting code, so you can detect some errors. It's not even a full error detecting code, it's a partial error. You can detect some errors, and it turns out that then some of the undetected errors do then map to nice local noise in the physics. So you can start to play with this. But I think this general framework just gives you the insight that you can study this. It doesn't really give you tools. Then you have to go and study the specific instances. And I mean, the general theorem just tells you this is something worth looking at. But I think then you actually have to go into the actual individual cases, and it can get very interesting. So I'm not sure it adds more useful tools than we already knew in the theory of error correcting codes, quantum error correcting codes, but it kind of gives you a new perspective on what you might want to, questions you might like to ask about a code.
Thank you.
Unless there's any more questions, let's thank Toby once again.